Get Puck.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Get Puck podcast. Matt, Vito, and Dave here. Gentlemen, how you doing?
Great. Oh,
getting great. Used to this time change.
Yes, good old daylight savings. So, we're post-trade deadline, boys. We made it. Everybody made it through unscathed. Let's talk about that real fast, because obviously something happened. I think we talked just before the trade deadline. We were kind of more in agreement. We didn't expect Jake Allen to be necessarily moved. Turns out he was the guy. Some of the other guys that we mused about moving and making deals for actually didn't move. In fact, Jake Allen is the only real transaction that occurred on this trade deadline, if we don't count the Monahan deal that happened about a month prior. So let's talk about Allen real fast. What's that?
You have to count it, but go on.
Okay. But I won't. So here's the thing about Jake Allen. We'll go through it as in case if anybody somehow, some way missed it. Jake Allen was moved to the New Jersey Devils. He was moved for a third round 2025 pick. And there's some nuance to the pick. If he happens to play 40 games in the 2024-2025 season for any team, and that team that he is playing for is going to make the playoffs, that third moves up to a second. So that's the condition. It's a potential second, probably not. So in all likelihood, you're going to end up with a third. And of course, there's 50% of the salary retained. So what do you guys think? Was this a good trade, bad trade, should have held?
We were having conversations at a certain point, given Jake Allen's season. Some people were even suggesting that Montreal had to add something to move him. In this case, they didn't have to add anything. All they had to do was retain a bit of salary. Basically, got back the pick they originally traded to acquire him years later. It was a third and a seventh, if I'm not mistaken, to acquire Jake Allen a few years back. And now they got a third round pick back that could upgrade to a second. It's a fantastic deal. And guess what? The carousel's over. It's done. Now, I know Dave might say it's another pick. What are we going to do with all these picks?
Don't put words in his mouth. The man's right here. Let him ask.
But at the same time, it's like, what were we going to get for Jake Allen anyway? The fact that they didn't have to give anything, and okay, they might be a little bit late. They should have probably traded him a little sooner, maybe last offseason, where his value is probably a little higher than it is than it was during the trade deadline. But the carousel's over. Primo's already starting the first game, you know, and it's going to be a home game. Like, it's done. It's done. And we got something for it. We didn't have to pay anything for it. That's how I see it.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a good deal. Fantastic is a very big word to use on a Jake Allen for a third round pick trade. But hey, it's a move. You know, it's a move. And you got to feel for Jake Allen a little bit because he sits in a three goalie carousel. Then he gets dealt to the Devils, and then they go acquire Kakinen. And so now you have a three goalie carousel in New Jersey with Dawes. And it's going to be interesting to see. Well, you do. You do. They were planning on using three goalies.
It seems like they're going to send down Dawes.
I think so, too, eventually.
Probably at one point. But still, I mean, he's having visa issues now, it seems. So, I mean, the guy just can't seem to catch a break. So, Jake Allen needed to get off this team, and they got him off the team. It didn't really matter what the return was. The return is fine. Moves to a second-round pick, whatever. I don't even – if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, it's not the end of the world. I agree with this trade. It needed to be done, and now hopefully we could see a little bit more of Caden Primo going forward.
How many people thought that it was going to be for a fifth or sixth round pick, just or that Montreal would have to add something to, like, and now it's like, hey, they didn't have to add anything. They kept their assets. They had to do is use a retention spot, and they got a third.
Yeah, but there's something to be said that he cheapened the value by waiting this long, right? Like, he definitely could have got more, I think, at the beginning of the year or when teams were a little bit more desperate in terms of goaltending and still in the mix. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. Yeah. I think that you know, whether it was going to be a little bit more or a little bit less, they did what they did, and they made the right move when it came down to it.
It's one of those bittersweet things, because I think most people see, if you're plugged into really any of the social medias that are out there and people's perceptions and the players' perceptions of this particular guy, he was a great dude to have around. He battled as much as he could when he had to take the number one reins when Carey Price went down. This was unexpected, you know. I think he even openly admitted, he said, I was here to be second fiddle to Carey Price and help the team when I needed to help the team. But I don't think anybody, himself included, expected to shoulder what he had to shoulder for the past couple seasons. And it's just one of those things, you know, you hope ultimately somehow, some way his play picks up and he gets a better shot somewhere else, and all the best to him, really. But obviously, given where the team is at today, there was no real spot for him. Caden Primeau finally moved up enough that he can be considered a legitimate backup. Maybe not the premier backup you'd want, but, you know, he's still developing, and so he can do the job, which is the important
Jake
thing.
Allen, and Jake Allen just recently said in an interview that Caden Primeau is the future of Montreal.
He's gonna pump the tires of his guys. I mean, they didn't hate each other. In fact, from what I've been reading, they were all really, really friendly, and they got along really great. So, of course, he's gonna send flowers to those guys, and Montembeau as well, of course, is the guy for now. I don't know if these two guys are going to be the future. I don't want to dive too much into this right now and give away future episodes about who we expect to be the future of the Canadiens backstop when they're really competing. But like Dave said, the three goalie carousel had to end. You know, for whatever it was, you know, if he could have gotten more, didn't, it's irrelevant at this point. The fact that Jake Allen is gone, you're retaining half of it. It's not a tremendous amount of money, but it is a retention spot for one more season, which isn't terrible. Because really it's the following year that I think you're going to want all the money available, because there's some huge names that are going to be in the market at that point when you're probably in year four-ish, moving to year five of your rebuild, and you should start being competitive. So it's the right time to get that kind of money. So that aside, yes, we're all in agreement with Jake Allen, but let's talk about the other aspect of the trade deadline. Again, putting the Monahan aside just for a second, there was one more minor league deal on the day, but there was nothing else done. We still have Armia, you still have Savard, you still have Anderson, you still have everybody. Does this disappoint you in any way? Like, apparently some fans are saying, oh, he should have fought harder, he should have done more to trade. Or are we in the camp of saying he had his price for specifically guys like Savard, and he held to it, and he didn't get it, and he said, well, the hell with you guys, I'm going to keep him, and I'm going to keep everybody, and I'm very content doing that. So what is your take on that? We'll start with you, Vito.
I think that he tried to move them, and he was going to use a retention spot for somebody like Armia, but when he saw what the return was, it was probably a better return to do that for Jake Allen than it would have been for Armia. So it's going to be easier to move somebody like Armia come next year's trade deadline, or even during the offseason when you see that there's only 1 year left. Teams are not strapped for cap and things like that. There's, you know, the cap's going up. It's always about the cap at the end of the day. Cap's going up this offseason. Teams might be a little more inclined to add a Yoel Armia to their lineup for a third or fourth line, a type of player who can help in the playoffs and whatnot. But it was tough. I wanted him to do the moves, and a part of me is like, you know, go move the Savards and go move the Armias and all that stuff. But at the same time, I kind of understand you need a balance of veteran presence, and to a certain degree, can you go pick up other veterans? Yeah, you can, but you have this one, and this one wants to stay here, and he's doing well in terms of Savard. And when it comes to Yoel Armia, what do you want to do? I don't think there was many suitors that were out there for him, even if his play had gotten better. If there was suitors for him, they would have gone and acquired him. They would have done everything they could to acquire him. There was just other players that were more attractive to the teams out there that they were willing to spend assets to acquire than Yoel Armia. So I didn't see anybody else potentially being moved. I know we discussed maybe Jordan Harris as a possibility, but he didn't go anywhere. I don't think he's going to go anywhere. I think that's more of an off-season type of move if he does move, and it's a complementary piece added to a bigger package, in my opinion.
That's fair. Dave?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think we went through it last week. Josh Anderson, going to be hard to move. Yoel Armia, going to be hard to move. Brendan Gallagher, you're not moving him. It's just there wasn't many people to move. Jake Evans, who's going to want him at a price that's reasonable and that makes you want to trade him in the first place? David Savard, I don't think he was ever going to get a first-round pick, which was reportedly Ken Hughes. Ken Hughes is a good general manager. He's not a miracle man. He can't just trade these guys for you know, and offload them. I don't think, again, we look at it through the lens of the as Canadians, Montreal Canadiens, people who cover the Canadiens and are fans of the Canadiens, and you look at all these guys that are available in our eyes, but I don't think they're that enticing to the rest of the league, especially with the salaries that they got from the previous regime. So I'm not surprised that nothing moved, and I don't think it's a fail at all on Ken Hughes' part. David Savard could most likely get moved next deadline, probably for a better pick than he would have got this one. I think it's interesting to see going forward. I don't think it was a disaster or anything. I think it was just, you know, he did what he had to do, moved what he – would you have liked to see it? Absolutely. You know, absolutely you'd like to see him move out more. But, again, it was never going to happen.
He made the more pressing move, Matt. He made the more pressing move, which was
the – Yeah, he needed to get rid of the goaltender. Well, that's
he had to do something. Yes. He had to do something. Yeah. The Jake Allen move, I think, was the play, and the goalie situation, the goalie market was the most likely scenario that you had teams that were out there. I'm still kind of surprised it was Jersey, but whatever, they completely revamped their goalies and got two new guys.
That was plan C. Yeah. For Jersey, that was plan C. So, it failed with Markstrom, it failed with whoever else they were trying to get. So they said, hey, you know what? We got to do something because our goaltending right now, no matter how we spin it.
Yeah, they had two rookies. They need. I'm surprised they went and got Kapanen also. But anyways, whatever. That's a Jersey.
Kapanen.
Kapanen, whatever, not Kapanen. Yeah, Kapanen. Sorry. Okay. I mean, I'm in agreement 100%. And I'm taking the stance. I think, if anything, this just shows how lucky Montreal fans are to have a guy like Kent Hughes at the helm. Because you have... We've all sort of lived the past regimes now, and it seems like trade deadlines then, it was exciting, of course, because names were flying everywhere, but they always seemed panicky. It was always like they were always doing these moves because they had to do moves because they were always on the hot seat. I got to do something. I got to get guys in. I got to bring in people. I got to move. I got to shake it up. Mm-hmm. Kent Hughes is sitting there with Jeff Gorton, and they're saying, we have a plan. We know people like action. We know the fans want to see the team moving in a direction, but we're going to take our time. He set his price, and apparently, like Dave was mentioning, for Savard, who was the only real other of asset of interest across the league, and he wanted a first. And he said, I'm very content to keep this guy. You guys want to offer me seconds and other things? No, I'm not coming down. I want what I want, and that's it. And nobody was willing to pony up, and so David Savard stays. And I don't think that's a knock on the team.
No, and I think that many teams, as you saw, holding cap seems to have been the trend in this trade deadline. And I don't think the Montreal Canadiens and Kent Hughes thought it was worth retaining any cap on somebody who's still extremely serviceable to them in David Savard. So there was no reason for them to move him. He was a vet in the back. They're going to use Matheson and David Savard as their veterans on the back end for at least another year before they make any decisions. I do think, though, Savard's time with the Montreal Canadiens is coming to an end, just not right now. I think by next trade deadline, if he's still with the Habs by then, he's for sure gone. And they're going to get a return that people are going to be like, oh, that's the return we should have gotten last year or whatnot. And it's going to happen, especially if he has another, if he's still another top five, top six defenseman for block shots and does all those defensive things as well as he did this year. But there was no, he only had one retention spot, and that was the key. That was the main enticing piece for the Montreal Canadiens or for any team to be able to make moves because of how the cap that only went up $1 million. You know what I mean? So it was tight for everybody, and there was about 16 teams that were operating in LTIR. It was really, really tough to make
for moves. Sure. For sure. I mean, I another thing I wanted to do is like throw out, you know, give it a grade. There wasn't that much action to really be like, oh, let's grade it. I mean, he sorted out the goalie thing to the best that I think he probably could have done. And when you look at Monahan, if we now package Monahan into the overall trade deadline aspect of things, I mean, that's huge. You see what he got for Monahan versus what players like Toffoli got on trade deadline. And you're like, this is unbelievable. Take a first for him and move him for a first. So two firsts overall, I mean, is just remarkable asset management by this organization right now.
You gotta say he had the foresight there. Absolutely. Maybe had the foresight. I'm not sure. You know, but
I mean, you gotta assume.
It seems like he did because if you would have waited to trade Sean Monahan at the trade deadline, some people would say, oh, you know, centers are more valuable, whatnot. Mm-hmm. Adam Henrique didn't go for that much either.
But Adam Henrique is not Sean Monahan. Sean Monahan provides more value than Adam.
I understand, which is why they got the first round pick, Sean Monahan, right? Yeah. So, and I know we were questioning the return at the time for Sean Monahan. I said I was okay. We got a first. That it is what it is. You know, could we have gotten an extra little piece? Maybe, but we got something. But to your point, Matt, given when you see what other players went for on trade deadline, and you think Sean Monahan got your first, which by the way is paying dividends for Winnipeg. Because he's kept
the pace, which has been fantastic for him. And now you got a team in Winnipeg, which I know a lot of fans are salty about from Montreal, from when Scheifele did the hit on Evans and everybody made Winnipeg public enemy number one for a while. But now they got Monahan and Toffoli playing for them. So you got to figure there's a little bit more, perhaps some like not vested interest, but when they get into the playoffs, you kind of like, you know, okay, go Winnipeg a little bit. Just saying.
How dare you say that out there?
I happen to like those two guys a lot. I think their stints in Montreal overall were very short, given the context of players that have been here a very long time. But they made tremendous impacts. I think Tyler Toffoli and I think Sean Monahan are very, very well liked in this city, and I imagine most people would be like, yeah, good luck to you. I'm not saying they're suddenly going to become fans of the Jets, but
how many people had Toffoli going to Winnipeg on their bingo card for the TDL?
Yeah, that was they're doing what they can do, right? A lot of people suggested and saying that Edmonton should have done a bit more. I think Winnipeg did the best that they can do, really. You got some big guys that came in there to help with this push. They're both UFAs at the end of the season, and that's something I want to pivot to in a second. But first, I want to talk about something that happened in the league a couple days ago, which was crazy. And I just think it's fun to talk about, given how often Montreal finds themselves in overtime. So you may or may not know, Minnesota was in an overtime game. I can't remember who they were just playing. If you guys know, tell me, but I don't remember who it was. And they need as many points as possible, right? They're really trying desperate to make it to the playoffs. In overtime, in 3-on-3 overtime, they pulled their goalie with no delayed penalty, all right, to get a fourth attacker on the ice, and they ended up scoring. So it ends up paying off for them, and they get the 2 points. Now, what most people seemingly didn't know, myself included, is if the other team would have scored on them, they obviously lose the game, but they also would have lost their loser point that they got for being in overtime.
I didn't know that rule. Admittedly, I didn't know.
I don't think anybody knew that rule. They even interviewed the players afterwards, and they said, we had no idea. So it's huge brass to do what they did.
Nashville.
Okay. So my question is this. Given that that's the rule now, and given how often Montreal finds themselves in overtime, could the organization not do this every single time under the guise of saying, hey, we want to get as many points as possible? We're not mathematically eliminated. We want to get as many points and the best opportunity to get the 2 points possible. However, if they get scored on, now they don't even get the loser point and go up in the standings, which benefits them also on the other spectrum of not getting too far ahead from the bottom for the best lottery odds. Is it crazy? Does everybody look and pull the eye down and be like, come on, we know what you're doing? Or too bad. It's legal.
I absolutely love it. I absolutely love the idea. I think that it's actually genius. And I don't see why more teams don't do it. I don't see, like, this loophole is obviously going to get fixed. Like, obviously, at the end of the year, they're gonna remove this rule, because I can't see, like, I fear a world where teams are trying to tank and they both pull the goaltenders in overtime.
Could you imagine? I was just thinking that. Okay. Could you imagine they both pull and they're both trying to shoot it across the ice?
I fear a world of where you're playing to be mediocre. And that's what I hate at. So, but while the rule's there, man, like, you see what Vegas is doing with their LTIR. Like, just abuse those loopholes, man. That's what you got to do to advance in life. And that's what you got to do. If you're the Canadians, if you're any team now, I mean, now the secret's out, man. You ruined it for everybody. You should have just called Kent straight up, called Marty and say, listen,
I got a lot more of these, Kent. You give me a call, baby. I'll share them with you.
But I'm telling you, man, like, that's a great idea.
One rule a year, and he knows.
And I think that the only thing that's going to prevent this from happening realistically is, like, hockey is such a, like, gentlemanly sport. And, like, Marty St. Louis will not, like, he'll take the high road and stuff like that. Yeah. Like, which is boring. Boring. It's in the rule book. It's in the rule book for a reason. So use it to your advantage. I think it's genius. Honestly, even if you're a competitive team, I would pull the goaltender. 4-on-3 is such a massive advantage in overtime. You see it time and time again where you just, you know, they end up winning. If you get a power play in overtime, most of the time you end up winning. And it's just, I would do it constantly. And I absolutely love the idea. If you're a tanking team, do it even more.
It's crazy because you get the thing of still being able to tank without the little connotation attached to it being like, oh, you guys are giving up and you're not even trying and it's that bad look. Here it's like, I put an extra guy out.
Yeah.
And like Dave just said, mathematically, 4-on-3, we have a significant advantage to score. You are trying.
You guys already tried this, working on your sales pitch to Kent Hughes. What's going on over here?
Listen. The world knows about it now because of what Minnesota did. Yeah. Prior to Minnesota doing it, I don't think anybody thought about this. John Hines, who's the guy there in Minnesota, genius. It was a genius move.
Yeah.
It was a genius move.
I feel like he just read the rule book like 20 minutes.
Maybe, or maybe he didn't even know.
There's a chance he didn't know. I don't know if anyone asked him, man. Like,
I don't know.
And if he would tell the truth, if he would be like, oh, yeah, I knew.
For sure he's going to say he knew. And it was a calculated risk. But don't, Vito, do you not agree with that? Is it like crazy? Or are you more like kind of like Dave's saying, like gentlemanly and no, you can't do that kind of thing, especially when even if they did it every time they got to overtime, the extra points will never make enough grounds to go to playoffs. So don't do it.
Listen, you do what you got to do to win. I kind of see it like in football when you have the choice to go for the 2 points or you just take the field goal. It's like it's either you play it safe or you take the risk. And Minnesota, kudos to them. They took the risk. It worked. I would say 98% of the entire hockey fan base and its staff and everything didn't even know about this.
For sure.
And it made it for entertaining hockey. But I could see, to Dave's point, I could see a world where, similar to when Philadelphia and Tampa Bay, if you remember a few years ago when Guy Boucher was the coach, they were playing the trap and nobody was moving.
Yeah, I remember. That was terrible.
And it forced the NHL to make a rule change there. And I could see something like that happening where they look and say, okay, if teams start doing this and, want to force the tank, then you do it. They're going to make some kind of rule.
Hold on a second. No one's saying force the tank. Hold on a second. Because I'm not saying pull the goalie, play 4-on-3, and then, oops, I accidentally missed my pass and it goes all the way back in your net. Try and win.
I see that if two teams do that, what we're suggesting, I could see Dave's idea that he brought up that was stolen by the PWHL recently, where they say, hey, to really get a good first overall pick, you have to play to win still, even if you're out of the playoffs.
They need to do that.
That's the golden rule? Is that what they're calling it? Is that the gold rule?
I don't know what they're calling it, but I like the idea of the rule. So you know how there's teams right now in the NHL that, you know, or even fans are saying they gotta tank, to get the best pick for the lottery odds and all that stuff. Well, it's the opposite. Even though you're eliminated mathematically from the playoffs, you still play and accumulate points to get the best loser status, if you will.
See, I didn't think to talk about this at all, but you mentioned it. I'm going to disagree with you on that one because I don't think that that's a good system. Because that means that if you are legitimately one of the worst teams in the league, when you're mathematically eliminated and you start gathering your points or however they start doing it, like, you're not suddenly going to win games. You're not going to play harder and play better to get the best.
But that's also the problem, though, Matt. You have a lot of teams that once they're out of the playoffs, they completely check out. It makes for boring hockey. Fans don't show up. They lose money.
Hold on a second. I don't agree with that either. I don't think players all of a sudden when they're mathematically eliminated.
Not players. Teams. When they move out all their players, when they put guys.
So, okay. That's a little bit different, though, because then you should do something to prohibit teams from just completely dismantling a team where you're putting pylons out there and then that's the end of it.
But they don't.
I just don't like the idea that you have a team that is terrible. And then realistically, if you put that plan in play, they're never going to get a top pick because they're never going to beat the other teams that are eliminated also.
I actually thought of a system that's a little bit better than that. And I think I spoke about it on this podcast. I have a feeling we spoke about this, or maybe we spoke about this off air, but that the number one team, the next team, the number nine team that doesn't make the playoffs, the team with the best record that doesn't make the playoffs,
the bubble team,
gets the number one odds of winning that lottery. So even if you're the last place team, you'll still get worst case second overall pick. So you're still going to get the top and talent.
You're playing for the first. You're playing for the first.
Playing for the first overall pick. You're in play. So that means guys between 9 and 12 are fighting it out all year, and the games matter. Imagine the Canadians had to freaking get to that ninth spot in order to have a chance. You could
so, widen it a little bit. But in that scenario, hold on a second, because in that scenario, again, I'm not suggesting the players have any care in this whatsoever with draft and stuff, but just from a team perspective, you have a team on the cusp of making playoffs. So that means you're not a top team. You're just a team good enough to maybe get in or maybe just miss. And the difference is you just get in, you get slammed four games straight by the number one team and you're done. Or you just don't get in and you get the first overall pick.
You don't necessarily get the first overall pick.
You get the best odds.
You get the best lottery odds. So like, let's say there's four teams that are bubble teams.
Yeah.
They you do a lottery between them.
And not only that, you... no, but you also have to keep the bottom team in that lottery too.
You have to
because you need the bad teams to improve. So you need to do that as well. So you take maybe the top two and the bottom two and you put them in a lottery together. And in that sense, you always say the players never give up. So the players are always playing to make the playoffs. Obviously the owners and everything, they want the playoffs more than they want a first overall pick, because at the end of the day, playoffs means money, means gate, means everything. You're moving forward. It's a good step in the right direction. It's a system that works. No team is going to be tanking to get out of that playoffs into that ninth spot. No team is going to
Chicago.
No. They're not good enough to get there. I don't think they're going to be in the last. They're going to be in the last place. I think it's a perfect solution to remove, not only to remove tanking, but to incentivize teams to play it out and make deals. You're going to see more deals maybe at the deadline where these bubble teams are actually going and also in the mix to go make these moves. So then it forces the top teams to get more creative with their trade deadlines, because the trade deadline has become stagnant, in my opinion, the past 4 or 5 years.
100%.
So this is also another way to switch things up and change things up. I know this is completely off topic. Maybe we need to divulge.
Well, we're 100% going to, and this wasn't scheduled at all, but this is an important thing to talk about because – of the way of the sheer nature of the way that the draft and the lottery is done today, I think is flawed. I think most people look at it and they understand, yes, it is flawed. They have been making, you know, periodic changes over the past couple of years. One of the new things I think they did, you know, again, not to go down this road too far, but like, you can't get the first, you can't win if you're after not
2 years.
If you're if not you in the back- worst position, this is where it gets complicated. If you don't have the best odds leading into the draft, and you win it twice, you can't win it again for 5 years or something.
Yeah.
It's something like that.
They're doing 5 years.
Yeah. So they're doing things like that to kind of, you know, limit the tank, if you will.
They call that the Edmonton rule.
It is
Edmonton rule. But that makes it boring also, because then if your team really just truly sucks, you can't even look forward to that if you're the fan base of
You're the last place guy.
Yeah,
every year, then you can win it each year consecutively, but the odds aren't in your favor. Anyways, we'll talk about that another time. That is fascinating stuff, however, and I am curious for people's perspective, because that was something that got brought up when the PWHL mentioned it, that they're doing, I think it's called the Gold Rule. What your take is about that, if you guys like it, dislike it, we'd like to hear what you have to say about that in the comments. But one last thing I want to get to, this upcoming offseason, not talking about RFAs, just talking UFAs. All right, we're going to put just the UFAs on the spotlight here. Montreal is going to have something like $10 or $11 million in cap space. And that's not counting the LTIR that eventually price being put on that is going to open up for them. They have to sign Jacki, which very, very, very likely they're going to do, obviously. There's also Yolonen, who's an RFA, who, if they sign him, is going to be probably less than a mil or maybe maybe. And I don't even think they're going to, given how much what they got coming up to replace him anyways. So let's say for the sake of argument, you got about eight and a half, something in that ballpark. I'm looking at the UFAs, boys. First and foremost, should they target a vet? Should they not target a vet and go and try to find another young guy to continue this sort of ideology of we want to be young, we want everybody to grow together? Should they do nothing and just leave it as open and whatever, you know, available to them moving forward, because the following year is massive. This upcoming year, when I look at it, if I pull off just based on points here, I mean, you got Sam Reinhart's a UFA. He's got the most points. He's got 76. He's having a career
year.
Yeah,
but that's a guy that's going to get it.
Exactly. Yeah. After that, though, after that, if I don't count age and I don't sort by age, you got Matt Duchesne's of the world. You got Jonathan Marchessault, which might be interesting, but he's 33. Stamkos, but Stamkos. Pavelski. Gensel is not likely going to come here. Lucas Raymond. Lucas Raymond is a UFA?
No, you have a mix of RFAs there.
I do. Let me just fix this real fast because I thought I sorted this properly. Although Lucas Raymond would be the guy I would want, but anyways.
Yeah, they're not giving up on Lucas
Raymond. Clearly not, and that's my point. That's why I don't want to talk about RFAs. Okay, so here you go. Sorry. Duchesne, Marchessault, Stamkos, Pavelski, Monahan, and Toffoli, which is pretty funny. Can be some, you know, something there maybe. Tarasenko, Henrique, you know, these are the kind of guys that are out there. And you're not looking at world beaters anymore. You're talking about guys that at this point in the season, you know, barring the top five, the rest of them have like 40 points, 34 points, 29 points. So my point is there's not really a ton out there. But that being said, how often does a team have that kind of cap space and do nothing with it? And then furthermore, before I turn it over to you, are you comfortable with if they do nothing? Because if they're going to do something, it's bolstering up front. It's getting goals, obviously. If you're comfortable with your first line, your second line, when everybody comes back, is now going to be Newhook, Doc, and Joshua Hua. Is that the second line you're cool with leading into the next season and doing? Or do they got to do something? I've talked enough. Tell me, boys. What do you think?
I think they got to make some moves here. Just in the sense that, like, they have the value of time, right? So they have the value to go looking at players they want. And I think it'll happen more through trades than it will happen through UFA signings. I think UFA signings nowadays, UFA signings, the big names are they're 30, 34, 30. Like, I don't think it really necessarily fits the profile of what the Canadians want to do. That's maybe players you add when you're really you're becoming a contender, you're becoming a playoff team, you go grab those guys. I think they're a year away at least. So I think for this season, I think you try to make that move where you go get a guy. Every year, there's these big name guys that become available. You just try to be the one to get that. And sometimes it's people you don't see coming. And Ken Hughes seems to be good at that. So if I'm Ken Hughes, I look back and I look at everybody in the league. I see who could be available. I call every single team and say, look, is there a guy you want to move secretly? You don't want, and you try to find a gem and you try to make a move that way. And I think a big move is needed. I don't think, like, you know, again, I'm not sold on that first line. I'm not sold on the second line as well. I think there's a lot of room for improvement there. A lot of room for improvement. And I think that you at the very minimum start. And I'm not saying that you have to make a deal and that it's a failure if you start next season without getting one of these guys. But I think you have to start looking for the next young core player of this hockey team. And you can't just bring up all these old guys, like these young guys from and expect them to fill the spots. I think you need a little bit of internal competition and high-end talent. So I think you start looking, because the closer you get to competing, the more the competition is going, like, people are going to know what you're looking for. Right now, they have the luxury of a bit of time, sit back, not feel pressured to make a move where they're going to lose a trade and just try to find that guy. But I think, I mean, look, you have the luxury of that salary cap. You need that cap space. You need to go get, you need to start moving some, picking up some pieces. Enough with the projects, enough with the draft picks. Let's go. Let's go now. Let's go.
So while I do agree that Kent Hughes has to go find that gem that Dave's mentioning and alluding to, but if you're forcing me and I got to take a UFA to add to the roster, there is one player I have in mind, because the same way the same way you have veterans on the back end that are calming the defensive defensemen that are young, the D-men, I think that Montreal can use a veteran to play on the up front and to calm things down there. You can see when Monahan was there how he was able to calm Suzuki and keep things going and whatnot. And when he left, Suzuki's still playing well, but there's missing something there. Joshua Roy, I think, would eventually be good on the second line. I think he's better suited for the third. I think he could have some very good numbers being a third line guy who could provide some secondary scoring. And I think that's like the perfect role for him. And if there's a player I would target in the UFA market, I think Jonathan Marchessault. If you can't get a right winger that's young and fits the mold, then and you can get a veteran. I think somebody like Jonathan Marchessault, who's been very productive, checks a lot of the boxes besides his size, because he is on the smaller side. But you could fit him with somebody like Doc and whatnot. You could make it work. I think just somebody like Jonathan Marchessault is a UFA that is intriguing, depending on the price.
So if you kidding.
Yeah,
the price is going to be for a guy his age. I think you're going to end up probably regretting the deal you give Jonathan.
Well,
and that's what's interesting, because he's 33. All right, he's 33. He's playing for Vegas. He got 56 points in 64 games. What's fascinating is you got the other two guys that I mentioned before. Now, I don't know what they want to do, and I know that Toffoli's been all over the map. He's been on a ton of different teams at this point. I don't know where his mindset is. I don't know if him and Monahan are looking at the Habs and saying, you know what, they're not that far away, and I want to be a part of it, because you can't expect either of those two guys starting next season to not be on a longer-term contract. But Sean Monahan's 29 only, and Toffoli is 32. He's a year younger than Marchessault. So if I put all three on the table for you, who would you choose? Hypothetically, if they were all willing to come here and sign, let's say, a four-year deal or something.
Well, you just said Marchessault.
Well, were you looking at the other two also, and you don't think there's a prayer they come back? Or
the only reason why I'm not looking at Monahan is because to me he's a center. While he can play wing, he's a center. And when I'm looking at Montreal's center lineup, it's clogged, especially with someone like Dvorak there. There's too many center pieces now, which is something that many years ago we wouldn't have been saying. But so I'm thinking somebody who's primarily a winger. There's no confusion in their identity. This is who you are. A veteran presence to calm things. Somebody who's gotten, you know, who has some miles under his belt. I thought of Jonathan Marchessault. So would I like to fully back with the Montreal Canadiens? Yeah, I would. He's successful pretty much everywhere he goes. However, I do think that Toffoli's next gig, is probably going to be to look for stability and stop moving. And I also think that Dave's right. Find that gem piece for Montreal. We don't know who it is, that secret piece, that something that Kent Hughes seems to be good at going and get. But
secret piece.
But also look for somebody like that where it tells the fans, we're not quite out of our rebuild yet, but we're in the next step now.
We're in the next
phase of this rebuild.
Marchessault might end up hitting 40 goals this year. Like, that's going to be a lot of money probably to sign Marchessault. Not that I'm saying, I think he'd be a great fit here. Don't get me wrong, for multiple reasons. You know, but I just think he's going to be too expensive. And I think he's going to get overpaid. And I think that he won't probably produce to the level that he's producing in Vegas for the amount of money that he's going to make. I'm in agreement with that, for sure, too.
I think you're not wrong. You're not wrong when you're saying he's going to get paid. It'll be up to former agent Kent Hughes to sell him on the idea and say, hey, you are going to get paid. You're going to probably get your long-term contract, most likely. But let's make no illusions here. This 1 year of him hitting almost 40 goals is not his norm. He is a 30. You could say now he's a 30-goal scorer.
30, and what do you think a 30-goal scorer puts him on this team, by the way? But that's an attractive thing too. I mean, his agent's got to be like, you want my guy? Okay, he's not a 40-goal guy. Even at 30, he becomes your number one goal scorer. Pay my man.
He was getting paid $5 million with the Vegas Golden Knights. Probably, I would say I see him at around that 6.3, 6.4 million around there. Now, do you want to pay him that as a Montreal Canadiens? That's up to you guys to decide that.
You might even have to overpay again. The tax thing here is always a thing.
I mean,
the fact that from here might play into, you know.
I don't buy into that anymore. Perhaps a tiny little piece of it, but like for the most part, these guys are out there. They want to get paid. I think the difference now versus any of the other, you know, past, I don't even know how many years, you know, decades probably, they're actually trending in a really good place. People that are looking at Montreal are saying, you know what? They're not there yet, but soon. There's something there soon. You can start seeing this team being perhaps a destination for some of these guys to say, I can actually win there, instead of having it always falling back on, oh, he's a guy to, from Quebec, and you know, he maybe wants to come and play home or something like that.
Well, you got to think, right? The guy has a cup. He might have two cups at the end of this season. He's been paid. You know what I mean? I think there's a lot of factors more than a guy who's hungry and chasing things. Like, I think that maybe there might be a play for him here. I think to Vito's point, I mean, there is a world where they get him. I think they would have to overpay, and I don't know if that's the right thing.
I wouldn't want to overpay as a last thought, simply because, and we don't have the time to really get into it, but the following year, you need a wide open cap availability to get some of the guys that are going to be UFA that following season, which is like some of the names up there are just crazy.
But be wary of that. I mean, a lot of these guys end up re-signing with
their sure. But to be able to play the game, you got to sit down with the chips. You lock them all up in Jonathan Marchand, so you can't really play the game.
Even at that, Montreal's got a lot of cap space available to them after next year. And that's even if they were to, that's even if they extend Slavkovsky, you know, some are already saying give him his big deal right away. It's like, you know what I mean? Even if you give him that kind of
money. Give away my next topics. Next week is the Slavkovsky contract.
You don't tell us anything.
That's it. I like to keep you guys in suspense. Anyways, thanks everybody for listening, for making it to the end. If you've done so and without skipping, good on you. We appreciate it. Let us know again. I like to always start with the questions at the end. What do you guys thought? What were your thoughts of the trade deadline? Do you like the return for Jake Allen? What do you think about the overtime thing, the Minnesota thing that they did? Curious about that. Was it just a goofy thing that they did one time and no one's ever going to replicate? Or is this something that legitimately some teams like Montreal should consider doing when they find themselves in the overtime as often as they do? Let us know in the comments below. And as always, for Vito and Dave, I'm Matt, and this was
Get Pucked.